This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with Kevin Lin. We're going to be discussing the economic crisis and a lot of current events. Yeah, I mean, it's insane what's going on right now, but I guess before we start things off, I think, Kevin, like, a good way to start is if you just want to give our audience, like, a brief, like, background information, because it's been at least a year.
Yeah, well, according to Skype, it's been just a little over a year since we last met.
Right, so if you want to just kind of, like, give some background information and your organization's Progressives for Immigration Reform and U.S. Tech Workers.
Sure, I'll start it off. I'm Kevin Lin. I am I turned 60 just a week ago, which is kind of cool, made it this far. According to my astrologer, the longest I've ever been in a life, so that's pretty cool. At least I got that going for me. Born and raised on a small farm in Pennsylvania, left home a couple days after I graduated from high school, went in the Army, stayed there for 11 years, ended up becoming commissioned an officer in the infantry, was later branch transferred to Intelligence Corps. Worked as a counterintelligence officer for 6 years in Europe and Asia. Left that, worked for Ross Perot for a couple years in his political action group. I had volunteered during the campaign, and after the campaign in 92, he hired me on. And then, got left politics, kind of got into working for large accounting firms as a business development guy. Like, I was a director at Ernst & Young. And kind of got back into politics again as a volunteer when Howard Dean ran for president, and was head of a chapter in Southern California, the Pasadena Democracy for America.
Back when you started out politically with Ross Perot and the Reform Party, and I noticed it's interesting, some people are trying to, I have no idea what they're doing now, but like some people are trying to revive that on Twitter. And then from the Reform Party and Ross Perot, you went on, you were kind of involved with the Zero Zeros Progressive Movement and the anti-war wing of the Democratic Party.
But
that's obviously very different than what is considered progressive now.
It's funny. I tell people that the Overton window hasn't moved to the left. It's moved to the crazy.
Right.
I couldn't identify as a progressive today, although I'm kind of stuck with this name that we created in 2008. then in 2008 was when I was on the executive board of the California Democratic Party as a delegate. I was in a town hall meeting on immigration, and I was speaking, and I said, you know, I'm the son of an immigrant. I think when my mother came here in 1952, everyone benefited from immigration. The new arrivals, the people that were here, it was restrictive. It was also well-regulated. And that is not the case today. And that's kind of how we started Progressives for Immigration Reform. I was on the board for many years, one of the founding board members, and then in 2017, I moved back to the East Coast, took over as executive director.
And I'm curious, I don't want to go on a too much of a tangent before we get to the economy, but I'm curious, like, do you still have a lot of people on the left involved with that organization, considering how crazy things are now?
That's a great point. I was in Dallas over the weekend, and I was meeting with one of our supporters there, and we were talking about how difficult it is for us, for instance, for us to raise money, because when progressives these days see what our mission is, they're like, no way. And people right of center, when they see the term progressive, just won't touch that with a 10-foot pole. So it's very difficult because when you looked at the environment years ago, people understood that there was a relationship between the number of people, particularly those in high carbon footprint countries like the United States, and the damage being done to the ecosystem. That was very prevalent in the 60s, 70s, and then the 80s, it started to fall away to where even the Sierra Club became very, very, where they were, were promoted restricting immigration and the numbers, looking at it in terms of the general population. But that has all fallen away. And that's really tragic, because you have groups like the Sierra Club that understood that relationship between the size of the
I
population and the
remember
environment.
even like the shift because I do remember like even like current sitting Democratic senators like the ones that are considered moderate like Claire McCaskill and John Tester, I think even some of those types voted against George Bush's amnesty. Then now obviously everything's changed.
Exactly. It's interesting. The founder of, when you look at people that founded, who were involved early on in Earth Day, like Senator Gaylord Nelson, who's the founder of Earth Day, he was emphatic about population and the numbers. And unfortunately, what had happened is it was really a corruption. For instance, Sierra Club, it's documented. This is not a fantasy. A fellow by the name of Galbaum
Oh, right.
donated a
Wasn't
hundred.
that around like the early 2000s?
I think it might have been the
Maybe the
90s, if
late
I recall.
90s.
Right. And it was only in the early 2000s that it was exposed. And I think the article ran in the Los Angeles Times about it, but Galbaum was a guy who had created some algorithm for Wall Street, was very wealthy, donated $100 million to the Sierra Club, with the stipulation that they would not mention immigration again. And that's when people like the current chairman of our board, Frank Morris, another one of our directors, Ben Zuckerman, were really just pushed off, exorcised from the Sierra Club.
And then if you want to comment on how you started Tech Workers, US Tech Workers.
Yeah, tech workers, boy, that's really the flagship now. When I took over as executive director in 2017, I realized the movement, that the immigration restrictionist movement, there was a blind spot, and that was these employment visa programs like H-1B, L-1, optional practical training, where those issues weren't being addressed, and these programs were bringing in a pipeline of cheap labor to literally displace our professionals. You can look at examples like what happened at Walt Disney, Northeast Utilities, SoCal Edison, Abbott Labs, what we are seeing going on right now with CSX Technology. We saw just last year or 2 years ago with Vanguard, where they're literally outsourcing all of these IT jobs, back office accounting jobs. And they're initially what happens is they will outsource them to an H-1B visa dependent consulting company. And in the past, Americans would have to train their replacements in order to get severance pay. It was crazy. So that's why we created U.S. Tech Workers, and that actually got us into the White House in August of 2020. And we've since I started, as I had mentioned, I took over as executive director in 2017. And the thought was that I would, you know, have the position for a year and then recruit an executive director. But this was, you know, Trump had come into office and it's been nonstop ever since on the immigration front.
So, yeah, to get to the economy, I think a good place to start is the definition of of recession. That's changed now. So it used to, I mean, basically the definition is two quarters of negative GDP growth, and that's no longer the case, for obvious like political reasons. And then kind of looking at like prior to the pandemic, even then, like you look like the yield curve inverted in 2019. Right. So really, like there should have been a recession prior to that, but then obviously there was all the stimulus, and there was a recession that was like, it was kind of bizarre because it was severe, but it was classified as very, very short, like the very, like the early part of 2020, like the late spring to early summer. And then you just have like all these, yeah, I mean, obviously the media kind of is lagging. The media is dishonest, but then they'll say there was no inflation, inflation's transitory, and then they'll start talking about it, but then they'll back down again. And it's pretty obvious it's that they don't want to spook the stock market, but then there's also partisan reasons. Like, if they support Joe Biden, they don't want to say anything bad about the economy. They're just overall dishonest, and like Bloomberg, they're calling it a vibe session, which is like, that's like top tier gaslighting, saying that, yeah, like the vibes, the recession is because of like bad vibes. And then you have someone like Jim Cramer, like he gave people like terrible advice on.
Oh, in 2000, on, right?
Yeah,
remember
the Lehman
2008?
Brothers crash. Yeah, and then like, why is he's still on the air, and he's sort of become like this, like a meme. But yeah, just overall, yeah, he's a total joke. And then overall, like, obviously the pandemic, like, there were small businesses were crushed, and it is true, like, a lot of the corporate chains, they were, for a while, they were increasing hiring because of the stimulus, but then overall, just, like, overall, there's, like, this downplaying of economic malaise, and, like, how the media downplayed inflation, and then the recession, and then, or they'll say a recession, it's going to be a mild recession. Even then, like, I know Jamie Dimon, right, like JP Morgan, he said there was going to be an economic tsunami several months ago, and now Jamie Dimon is back to saying the economy is doing great. But then Mark Zuckerberg, even he admitted that there was going to be a severe recession. So they just kind of like fluctuate back and forth, and it's insane. But yeah,
It's interesting.
And just
and
looking
let's
at
go
how,
back
like, the stock, yeah, like, these bear rallies, have even though, like, the stock, even though the economy is bad, like, you are still seeing these, like, stock market rallies, and it's just not, I mean, the stock market's not a really good, it's not really good to rely upon as a metric, but I think, like, something like the misery index, that's a much better metric to rely upon rather than, not just stocks, but I'd say even more so than jobs.
Absolutely, because I think at this point we're seeing a huge disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street. And let's unpack this. You know, you mentioned what is a recession early on, and I like that joke that goes, it's a recession when your neighbor is unemployed, and it's a depression when you're unemployed. And I know a lot of people right now that are working, even though, you know, you see, you know, they're looking to hire people. I know a lot of businesses that are cutting back. So this has...
Well, they were, for a while, they were looking to hire people, but that was a very... The thing is that that is true, but it was a very temporary short period of time due to, like, just all the massive flow of stimulus.
I was going to say, you know, it's interesting... in between, what I had done for several years was commercial property tax in California. And I had clients there in California, Arizona, Texas, Florida, and the District of Columbia. And I had left that for a while, but I got back to it in late 2006 because for me and others that understood real estate, we knew it was going to get bad. All you had to do was look at the cost of housing, what was going on in both the private and commercial real estate markets, and then what was going on in terms of wages. And they just didn't correlate at all. Wages were essentially stagnant, whereas real estate was going through the roof. So where you want to be when real estate tanks is doing property tax work. So I personally got out of the markets in early 2007. I got into doing property tax in late 2006, went back, a bunch of us who had done it earlier and not made a lot of money, but we all thought we were going to get rich. And eventually the market did what we thought it would. It just imploded.
Are you talking about more recently or before?
No, I'm talking 2008 because right. it's important because there's implications for today. But the thing is this, none of us made a lot of money, you know, and I left that in 2014. So I did it for about 8 years, whereas we should have been wealthy doing property tax, but, you know, we kind of got by. And the reason for that is we were not prepared for QE1. Oh, well, remember TARP?
Yeah.
We weren't prepared for TARP, QE1, QE2, QE3, all of these things that would have these assets that whose values had dropped to the ground, banks would have been dying. Because when this happened at the end of the Reagan administration, we had the savings and loan debacle. All of these stranded assets were placed into the Resolution Trust Corporation, and they were being sold for 10 cents on the dollar, essentially. I know because my office was the one that a fellow who was a real estate mogul who had become the governor of Arizona, I was in his office. So it was interesting times. But so this, as you mentioned, the stimulus, we became habituated, I think, to the stimulus. So the market doesn't respond the way it should. And I think this is really unhealthy, because we should have had this cleansing of the markets. All of these mispriced assets, whether they were equities or real estate, should have went to ground, and then we get back to normal, get back to good. But that never happened. So I think we've been in this weird world. And then, of course, we saw that too, don't you think? Just prior to COVID, the overnight lending of the banks.
Right.
They didn't, right.
Yeah, all throughout the 2010s, so like it's called like, I forget who called it like, well, the super bubble, I forget who called it the bubble to end all bubbles. I forget who coined that, but yeah, like not just, we have the bubble from COVID, the pandemic, but then we also have like the bubble left over from the 2010s that was supposed to crash when the yield curve inverted in 2019, but that didn't happen. I mean, obviously, as you pointed out, there should have been a much worse crash in 2008. Like, I don't know, like a severe recession or even a depression. But again, like all these things like the TARP stimulus, quantitative easing, it was successful, at least temporarily, in propping up the economy. And the bubble was maintained for most of the 2010s and then the pandemic. So yeah, they do take, like bubbles take longer to pop than anticipated, because even with the mm-hmm. tech bubble, that took from about 2000 mm-hmm. to 2002 to pop. So it is,
right.
It's sort of a gradual thing. Like, who knows how long this will go on for? Like, we could see a major stock market crash. For some reason, they seem to happen in the fall. I have no idea why, but yeah, like we could see a major one in the fall, but who knows? Like, this could go on for another year or two. But they do
really
take longer
could.
Than anticipated. But the thing is, like, with, like, the quantitative easing, and now I know, like, the new bill from Joe Biden, there might even be a tax on stock buyback. So we have that. And then depends to see, like, what the Fed will do with quantitative. If there's going to be quantitative tightening, and they've been really, they've done the interest rates, but the Fed has been hesitant to do quantitative tightening, but like with stock buybacks, like that's that could very well be taxed. And certainly, like right. You pointed out, people are very delusional and delirious during bubbles. But like all the like respected, like even mainstream financial figures like Michael Burry, Larry right. Granton, and Charlie Munger have, you like even like fairly establishment figures in finance have predicted a major crash. And even like or Muhammad Alirian, but then even then,
yes,
he's kind of backing down now.
Interesting. You know, just over the last couple weeks, Andy Schechtman had mentioned, and this came out yesterday, that he had a client that bought $50 million from him in gold and silver and demanded that it all be, you know, either American Eagles or Buffaloes. So they did about $25 million in gold and the balance in silver. And this was a billionaire, and they gave him permission to talk about the deal because he was, you know, doing everything he could. He was talking to every wholesaler he knew to fill this order. And as crazy as they think, you know, apparently the accountants of this woman who did this, the deal went through. And she had stated there are other billionaires looking to buy hard assets like gold and silver. So, I mean, that's really, don't you think, putting your money where your mouth is, where these people really are,
I'm hearing that, like,
transitory.
All the billionaires are buying up, like, hard assets, gold or farmland, and they're selling their stocks. Well, I guess what I've heard is more like the propping up of the stock market with these bear rallies. It's more to do with like small scale, retail investors are propping up the stock market. But most of the billionaires have sold off like most of their stocks.
Yeah, I mean, when you have someone like a Michael Burry telling you to get out, I think we should. And I think what we're seeing are these machinations that they've been able to prop up the equity markets while at the same time selling Main Street down the old proverbial
tubes. It's just remarkable. There's people who appear to be financially well off who are so, it's either they're so ignorant or stupid to buy the propaganda, or they're just really desperate or greedy. Could be both.
Yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, personally, in 2009, I was the smartest guy in the room because I was out of the equity markets. Everything I'd forecasted about the commercial real estate market had come true.
And that's supposed to be the biggest bubble to crash this time, commercial real estate.
I agree. You look at the vacancy rates. But the thing is, Rob, I didn't get back into the equity markets. You know, that was my mistake because I didn't catch the big uplift from there. But I think this time, because we're seeing, and what I don't even know what's propping up the commercial real estate markets now. When you look at the vacancies of some of these large properties, for instance, a friend of mine, they had an office in the Transamerica building in San Francisco. And beautiful office in that they had large windows that opened up to the bay, and they're all working from home now. They didn't renew their lease. So I don't understand how commercial real estate, particularly office, is surviving right now.
Yeah, who knows what's going to happen. It's going to impact it will have on remote work, or it could be, I mean, long term, it could be converted to real estate. But the next few years, I mean, that's going to be that bubbles. I think like the 08 crash, it was more residential real estate, and that's vulnerable
right.
too. But commercial real estate is a big one this time. And then just going over like jobs number, unemployment, like this new jobs report, that is very bullish, and it looks good on paper, like saying that 500,000 new jobs were created. But then you have to look at the more specific details. So one thing I've been hearing from various financial YouTubers is that there's a good video from the YouTuber Money GPS about this. but that a lot of people working multiple jobs are counted. Also, people working part-time could be counted. Then there's been like the summer job growth in like tourism, leisure, and hospitality, which that's summers tend to have more economic growth in general because like tourism's part of that, but that's obviously temporary, and like those jobs are all going to be gone in the fall. So yeah, and then also you have to factor in like the jobs recovered from the pandemic rather than new jobs created, and then yeah, like all these different factors. So like you have to think about wages are declining if you adjust them for inflation. And then sometimes jobs do spike slightly, like right before a big recession. I have no idea why, but that's just something that has that happens. And then, yeah, like a lot of the good jobs report means that the Fed is now pressured to raise interest rates. That's a factor too. And then also, we've talked about this before, but unemployment stats don't count those who are no longer seeking employment. And then I remember last month there were reports of mass layoffs, especially like white collar jobs. So the jobs being created, they're low wage jobs, either manufacturing, retail, or the service sector. And like you saw that Walmart is laying off a lot of their corporate positions. So yeah, and then also there has been talk of like labor shortages, but that's obviously, but overall, like the jobs report appears like a bunch of bullshit.
It is. I mean, it's really a doctor document. And every time I see something rosy painted, what they'll do, they'll do a revision the following month. And it's like, oh, yeah, it's not so rosy. But you're right about the layoffs. I mean, Tesla just laid off 229 people in San Mateo. And these, I think targeted.
Especially tech, because tech is more dependent upon Fed policy like quantitative easing than other industries.
Right. And this kind of gets into, our U.S. tech workers group. Right now, there's a healthcare outfit in Ohio that's laying off 650 IT and back support people. And what they're doing is, they're going to move all that stuff to an H-1B visa dependent Indian consulting company. So that's how we're getting the wage stagnation, because you would think when you look at the productivity gains of American workers over the past 20 years, we haven't seen that reflected in wage growth because there's all kinds of ways, through immigration, whether it's people coming here legally to work as immigrants or illegally, there's wage suppression.
So they're counting. That's another factor I forgot to mention that, but among job growth, you have to factor in, it's also counting, so immigrants are also counted in new job growth.
Right, exactly. Because it's pretty well documented. There's at least 12 studies that I could point to, studies done by like Anthony Ito, Joseph Price, David Yeager, Michael Amwar. These are all peer-reviewed studies that will demonstrate that, for every percent of increase in immigration, there is a corresponding drop in wages. So, you might look at a demographic like, black men who dropped out of high school. That could be as much as 1.7%, the differential there. So that's another. So we've seen this really squirrely. Here we are in the middle of an inflation. So you would also expect to see wage inflation, but we haven't.
It would be interesting to see if the government, or just establishment in general, pushes more immigration to overcompensate for the real estate, for the crash in real estate.
I'm glad you brought that up. About a month ago, I did a paper entitled, if you thought NIMBYs were bad, meet the YIMBYs. And NIMBY is not in my backyard, and YIMBY is yes in my backyard. So we...
Right.
you know, have all these people that are welcoming, you know, immigrants. But what they don't realize, you know, if you're a wage earner or a salaried professional and you've got a fixed income, you're feeling this affordability crisis when it comes to, you know, real estate, whether it's buying or renting. And, you know, according to the New York Times, home values and rents have absolutely skyrocketed, where at the same time, wages have remained stagnant. And this, you know, in large portion, again, is due to immigration. I'll give you an example. You know, in a Bloomberg article recently, Center of Real Estate Director at MIT, an economics professor, his name is Albert Says, found that a 1% increase in immigrant population at the metro level leads to a 1% rise in housing prices. And you're still in California, right?
Right.
So think about it. In Los Angeles, in that metro area, 33% of the population are foreign-born.
Oh, and
you wonder why there's an affordability issue.
Yeah, the supply and demand issue. And I guess your point about YIMBYs is they talk a lot about supply. I mean, they're right about supply, but then your criticism of them is more... There are different... Like, you have these, like... That's a whole... I mean, that's like a whole other, like, tangent, but you do have these, like, kind of left-wing, left NIMBYs who say they're in the pockets of, like, big developers and, like, BlackRock, and that's, like, a whole other tangent mm-hmm. off the economy. But it is interesting, your critique of YIMBYs is more their... So their cornerstone policy is increasing the supply via reforming zoning, but then they're part of a kind of broader... like philosophical, ideological framework that includes immigration. That was your point in the article, I think.
Right. You know, live denser and be happier kind of thing at the end of the day. And that's just, it's just simply not working that well.
I mean, the other thing is then you have, if you're, say, a NIMBY, you do have, in like the Bay Area in LA, like a lot of affluent, like limousine liberal, like older homeowners are both... for immigration and then NIMBYism, like the kind of example, like one of my articles about like overpopulation in California, I reference like Rob Reiner in Malibu. And that position, like if you're NIMBYism plus immigration, isn't that worse because you're constraining supply and demand even more so?
Absolutely. I mean, and I love that article, by the way. That was great. I mean, don't you find that they're just so darned hypocritical at the
right.
end of the day? And, you know, I'm looking at, there was a Urban Institute article, paper about, you know, how these developers, again, because, you know, to meet the demand, they got to build the apartments and the homes, but the people building them love to exploit, you know, illegal immigrants because they can reduce their overall wages by 40%. You know, doing this, their costs of building a house by 40%. And yet, you know, what they're getting for these homes keeps going up and up and up. It's really a strange set of circumstances there in Los Angeles.
Like demand, there's going to be demand like in certain like core areas, but like they're still building like a lot of these places. One of the financial YouTubers like Jeremiah Babe was showing these like new tract housing subdivisions going up in the Inland Empire and the Coachella Valley, like Palm Springs area. And like he sees like, yeah, I do see like they're under construction, but you see a lot of similarities to like the 08 like crash and foreclosure crisis.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's, you know, it was funny when the bubble burst in 2008. Again, I'm sure you watched that movie about Michael Burry. What was it called?
The Big Short.
The Big Short. You know, at that time, I didn't do it, but I knew people that were shorting home builders for all the same reasons. And the problem is you just had to have the timing right, because then, you know, and you had – You saw Lennar's stock price collapse, Pulte's collapse, Meritage Homes collapse, KB Home collapse. But now they're all back to good. But even there, I don't think they're doing that well right now. I haven't looked at them recently. But I think this time around, as you mentioned, I think we're going to see a real hit to commercial real estate.
Yeah, I think it will be both, but I think it'll be commercial real estate more so because of the added like pandemic angle. Mm-hmm. And then, but then again, like maybe if a lot of that commercial real estate is transformed into housing, depending on like taxation and zoning regulations, that could be a good thing long term.
You mean like to adaptively reuse?
Yeah, adaptively reuse like office to housing, but long term. But I think short term, it's going to be a disaster. But then I do want to get to kind of inflation. And yeah, basically does seem like inflation, plus GDP decline and slowing economic growth. And yeah, so the Fed, they're raising interest rates, but I'm not really sure if quantitative tightening, QT, like some financial YouTubers are alleging that the Fed is actually the Fed is outright lying about quantitative tightening, but regardless, they seem fairly hesitant about that. But it is overall, it's like the worst PMI since the last yes. two recessions, the worst inflation since the 70s. And I think kind of looking back at what happened in the 70s is like right now, the number, again, like with jobs, like the inflation numbers could also be big. Some people are saying it's as high as 18 or even more 18% or more, but the official number is about 9%. And in the 70s, inflation, like a taper, but then there was like a big surge again. So yeah, that could likely happen. It could kind of taper off at 9%, and then we could see another big surge where it goes up to like 15 to 20%. So yeah, like just all these different kind of narratives about inflation, and obviously, yeah, like narratives about like price gouging from the left. And I think that is true. I think there is price gouging by corporations. But it also downplays then the reality of inflation is caused by financial and monetary policy. So there is both price gouging and inflation. And obviously spending more, like Biden's ironically titled Inflation Reduction Act.
Weren't they denying inflation?
If he was going to write everyone a check, it'd be one thing, but it just seems most of it like more just pork spending and corruption, and it's only going to make inflation worse. So, yeah, I mean, obviously inflation's a huge problem. And then with these kind of like narratives, like it's kind of framed as like modern monetary policy versus like we need more austerity. And then even kind of going back to like the pandemic stimulus, like the spending did cause inflation, but there's also like a lot of gaslighting on how the revenue was spent, because it's sort of like most of it was pork, either to state bureaucracies or like PPP loans to corporations, bailing out like state governments and corporations. But there's a lot of gaslighting because like the amount of money that people got in direct stimulus payouts, stimulus checks was actually like not actually only like a small, very, very, very small percent of that.
Well, you see, that gets me into that. What you just said made me rethink a lot of this nature of the inflation, because a couple of things cause inflation. One is you have a lot of money chasing a lower supply of goods. And we've seen that during the pandemic where we had disruptions to the supply chain.
Yeah, it's a number of things. It's the Fed and monetary policy and printing. It's supply chain issues. It's price gouging. And then also, I think the other thing that doesn't get talked about less is when someone is able to borrow from a private bank due to low interest rates, that also contributes to inflation.
Yeah, but like you said too, when you looked at what actually got down to the people and you looked at the size of these stimulus, bills, very little actually got to the people that went into buying the purchase of goods and services. And a lot of it actually ended up as bank reserves that ultimately were not let out. And so perhaps at one hand, we do have this inflation that's being caused by, you know, a lot of dollars chasing small amount of goods. But then also, is it also being created by the weakness of the dollar itself? So I'm not sure where it's actually coming from. I question where it's coming from. I'd like to get your thoughts on, do you think ultimately it's transitory or not? Because I think it is in the long run transitory, because I believe we have a big deflation event coming up. I think we're going to have a depression, not this year, but possibly we'll see it next year. And I think we're going to be in the soup for a long time.
Like, there could be, I mean, either way it's bad. There could be, I see a number of scenarios. I see kind of like long-term stagflation lasting about three to 6 years, where it's just kind of like where inflation lingers and we have a gradual GDP decline. Or we could have like a really severe recession due to a depression, but it's deflationary. Either of those two scenarios could happen, but either scenario, either way, it's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think these things are naturally occurring. If the markets were left to themselves, I think we'd see some ups and downs and eventually out, but some real aberrations are out there. You know, I'm just looking at the war on food. What they've been doing here in this country, as well as the Netherlands and Germany, and I just scratch my head and go, why? What is going on?
And again, there's a case, there are legitimate ecological issues about food production, but it doesn't seem like that. It just seems like a blatant power grab.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I guess, and then also with the dollar, like with inflation, you'd think the dollar should be weakening, but then for a while, like it was reported that actually the interest rate, like temporarily the US dollar was strong, and like it was much cheaper to go to Europe. And mm-hmm. But who knows? I mean, who knows what's going on? Maybe temporarily, maybe raising the interest rates does give the dollar advantage over other nations, because the US is a world reserve status. So yeah, raising interest rates does screw over other nations' economies, and it was kind of when Volcker raised interest rates in the 80s, it caused an economic collapse in Latin America. But again, it is kind of a way to give the U.S. economy leverage over other nations. But like the degree, like with the world reserve currency, U.S. world reserve currency, like the degree it's at risk, because I don't see China, like with their economy, the yuan or the yuan or the renminbi, yeah. Like I don't see China having the world reserve currency, but I could see a kind of like bifurcation where the U.S. is the world reserve currency for its own geopolitical sphere, and then maybe either China or the BRICS nations have their own reserve currency.
Because I think to be a reserve currency, there has to be a bedrock of the rule of law. I mean, I wouldn't trust an audit. I don't care if a big four accounting firm did it in China or Hong Kong. I wouldn't trust it
in
Russia.
I don't really see that happening. I think the United States is in decline. But China, I don't really see China becoming a total superpower either. I see a multipolar world, or a bifurcation between the U.S. geopolitical sphere and a Sinosphere.
Yeah, and I kind of see that myself. I think the battle ultimately is for Eurasia, and which is why I'm really concerned about the stance. You know, the European countries, whether you want to call them NATO or World Economic Forum, and the U.S., I mean, Russia doesn't ultimately have a friend in China. Their lot is better thrown in with Europe. And I think that's what we're pushing them into China, and we should be bringing them closer to Europe. And for those very reasons. And, where is China? I recall, having turned 60, back in the 1980s, were all these books out about, Japan is number one and the power of the Ministry of...
I mean, that was the case with Japan. I think you get, I think right-wing populists like Tucker Carlson say that, they say China's going to take over the world, and then on the other hand, the geopolitical consultant Peter Zeihan, I don't know if you're
yes, I love Peter. Yeah,
he says the opposite. China's going to collapse, but I think it's the reality is somewhere in between. China has vulnerabilities such as they're rapidly aging, and yes. They have supply chain issues where they have to import most of their food and oil, but they have leverage with the Silk Road and with other nations. So I think there's some nuance between Tucker Carlson and Peter Zeihan.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think you're right. Ultimately, the truth is going to be something in the middle. As Zeihan likes to point out, China has a lot of vulnerabilities, mostly dealing from, coming from their supply chain.
I think also the supply chain, they import basically all their food and oil. So the U.S. in a war, with the naval blockade in the Strait of Malacca, they're very vulnerable, their aging issue. Then also the middle income status of a nation, where they don't have, they're not quite a rich nation, but they can't depend on providing cheap labor like a third world nation. They have this vulnerability being a middle income nation.
Absolutely. Years ago, it was during the Obama administration, I had a conversation with the CEO of Air China. And he literally said to me, he said, "You think you have demographic problems, look at ours." And he began to say, by this, point in time, so many people will be in retirement age.
The aging issue, that's also going to contribute to financial issues. Because what happened is, I'd actually say the developed nations aging, because what happened is when the boomers were saving for retirement, that propped up the stock market.
Sure.
And pumped in a lot of money to the developing world. But when there's this mass retirement, that's going to have a huge impact on the global economy and the stock market, including in developing nations as well.
Yeah, and that gets us into the conversation on the fourth turning and the turnings. As Harry Dent was always very quick to point
right.
out, because he looked at it from an economic standpoint, whereas Strauss and Howe kind of overlaid politics and geopolitics.
Also, Peter Turchin has his own take on that as well. I think he uses, some scientific metric to measure crises in these, cycles.
Yeah, because, Nenner has his software, Martin Armstrong has his Socrates, but, as Dent would say, the Great Depression was caused, and this reinforces what you just said, the Great Depression was caused when the Henry Ford generation started to retire. They weren't buying cars, homes, college educations. The stagflation of the 70s was when the Bob Hope generation was retiring and pulling on those retirement savings.
You're saying the Great Depression was when the Henry Ford generation was retiring?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's Harry Dent's view on it. And I subscribe to that because, people can say, World War II got us out of it to an extent, but ultimately it's the dog wagging the tail. The economy is just so powerful. And when you look at, Harry Dent's there calculating when Americans will be buying the most potato chips. I mean, there's a point, so that's how I kind of look at the economy. At this time, and 2008, is when the boomers started.
The best two metrics, it's buying potato chips and the misery index.
Yeah,
those two.
Exactly.
Yeah, just all these things going on. Obviously, the Ukraine war impacted supply chains with fertilizer, post-date, wheat, just all exacerbated existing supply chain issues, and then interest rates are going to impact the third world, and we're seeing global civil unrest. Sri Lanka is the best example,
yeah.
But you're seeing in other nations too. I think Peru, Pakistan, just countless, and the risk for global conflicts. I don't really see There's issues with Russia getting entangled in a conflict directly with NATO, and then like Taiwan and China and the whole like semiconductor issue with the supply chains. But I think most likely it's just going to be like a series of like smaller wars like spread out. It's hard to predict that.
It's really hard to predict.
That's like the more likely scenario. But yeah, like just going back to like the economic scenario, it seems to be like the stagflation of the 70s plus the debt crisis of 08 and the housing crash, a tech bubble. Then on top of that, there's not going because of inflation and debt. And then there's like the supply chain issues, but because of inflation and the debt, it's going to be very difficult for there to be a kind of another bailout like there was after the 08 crash. And then what happens is either if people are mass unemployed and there's no help, there's going to be mass civil unrest. But if there is help, that will increase inflation. So that's like a worst case scenario, but that's the kind of like worst case economic scenario.
In the fourth turning, you can, I don't think we're going to even, I am sure that in 1930, let's look at 1935. I'm sure no one would have said there's going to be this world war that's going to kill 40 million plus people. It's going to be waged all over the world.
It's like the end of history concept. People assume that the status quo is eternal, which is
right.
Which is idiotic.
And, you know, I'm reminded, Oswald Spengler, who was the last of a long line of German historian philosophers, wrote a book called Decline of the West. And in the introduction, he was talking about how everyone was calling him this great soothsayer because he actually laid out pretty closely World War One and the tensions leading up to it. You know, the assassination of the Archduke was simply the match that got dropped on a lot of fodder for the flames, or the kindling for the flames. But, you know, I think we could see where there's a lot of tension, where there's going to be competition for scarce resources.
Predictions for that there could be, like, a scenario like Egypt would go to war with Ethiopia about the whole like water supply of the Nile and the dam Ethiopia is building, like scenarios like that.
Mm-hmm. And why wouldn't they? Energy is, as Doomburg says, energy is life. People will go, and we rely on fossil fuels. You know, getting back to Peter Zeihan, he says that we're in this great position, but I think his logic is flawed because he has this notion of Saudi America and the bedrock of that is fracking. And unfortunately, these fracked wells, they produce, but they dissipate pretty quickly. Within a few years.
Dude, I think Zeihan, I enjoy listening to him, but I do think there could be like some bias as him being a consultant to corporations. But I think in some ways, like he talks about these crises, but maybe he does. Yeah, he's actually like maybe overly optimistic about America because he thinks that America having the energy resource advantage is enough. Like he talks about these serious crises, but in some ways he can be overly optimistic.
Yeah, I think so. It's so somewhere between Peter Zeihan and Chris Martinson. Have you watched or listened to any of Chris Martinson's podcasts or courses?
Oh, no.
He has a site called Peak Prosperity, and he talks a lot. His battle cry is you can't have infinite growth on a planet with finite resources. So, you know, people like me and Chris get labeled Malthusians.
Yeah, I think like deep ecology or similar. I'm not familiar with him, but it reminds me of like James Howard Kunstler.
Yes, actually, in 2018 or 17, I had Chris Martinson, James Howard Kunstler, John Michael Greer, Dimitri Orlov, and Frank Morris.
I was listening to a podcast I did of James Howard Kunstler in 2016, and he actually used the word an economic reset back then.
Interesting. Wow, because I think that's what, you know, folks like the World Economic Forum are gunning for. But don't you think, Rob, what's coming out of these, let's call them a spokesmodel for evil, Klaus Schwab, this notion of you will own nothing and like it, that's frightening to me. And if that's what they're looking to create, which they seem to be down the track of.
I think that's what a lot of the segment of elites want. But the thing is it take for that kind of like these dystopian scenarios, like they take that immense amount of organization. I just think there's too much like chaos in the world for something like that to be pulled off.
I think like we're seeing it in Sri Lanka. I mean, right. Here in the U.S., it will manifest in high prices, and sometimes high prices are the cure for high prices. But in places like Burma, Sri Lanka, Peru, these are government topplers.
Yeah, like the Arab Spring, and then in the Arab Spring, like it's much worse. That happened, and that was only like that was far less significant issue with food supply than what's going on now. Before I wrap up, I guess I would like to touch on a few other issues, but since you were talking about immigration at the beginning, do you have thoughts on some of the current issues with the current border crisis, which obviously the current border crisis is going to get much worse because of all these global crises that we just talked about, and then a number of things like the Supreme Court ruling, which actually was Trump's appointees who ended Trump's Remain in Mexico policy, and then a lot of like policy issues, and then you also talked about like tech layoffs, and that's in connection to immigrant visas. So your thoughts on like immigration policy where it is now, and the crisis at the border, which I think it could be I'm not sure, but it could be the worst in history.
Yeah, oh, it is the worst in history. Already, more people have rushed the border by August of this year than all of last year. And last year was about 2 million people. This is insane. But I like to take a step back and get really conspiratorial, because there's a context that I like to put all this in. And I think it goes back to the 90s when they couldn't fix Social Security and Medicare, and they knew eventually those were going to run out. I think what happened is they stopped investing in America, because this was when, you know, we saw, you know, they began the offshoring of jobs, the investment in jobs, and started bringing in a workforce that didn't have the expectations for retirement at 65 or at 67 now.
That's true, but Medicare, because there's so much chaos, like it's going to have that much change in a short period of time has a kind of accelerationist impact. And like,
exactly.
What's going on with the governor of Texas? Like, I was kind of like, what he's doing, shipping people from the border from Texas to New York. Like, I was at first kind of dismissive of him as kind of the usual Republican thing, where Republicans do things that are symbolic to make a point, but not really. But this is actually this has had a tremendous impact. You think about like corporate interest, and they want it kind of like orderly. They want change to change society, but they want at least like to happen orderly, because it's like everything is happening at such a fast rate. Like the kind of relevant to like the turning theory and crisis, it is like having an accelerationist impact.
Yeah, it's almost, because along that accelerationist theme, it's like they had this long-term plan.
So I guess there's dissident figures who are, they call themselves accelerationists. It's like worse is better. The more chaos happens, like the more of a backlash that's like there's going to be. That's a philosophy. And then there's speculation whether like those in power, whether they're accelerationist or they it's more like the frog in the boiling pan theory.
It's interesting. Yeah. Machiavelli, who believed in like, if you're right. going to just clean house, get it over with. But I'm thinking the intention was that Hillary Clinton was going to be president, you know, win the election of 2016. And then we would have seen the war with North Korea. Then we would have had a controlled COVID as opposed to one that kind of was the release of it was a bit fractured. And the rush to the border would have been more controlled and sustained. It wouldn't, and they'd have been more in control of the levers of power.
Yeah, like what's happening? Like the whole the FBI raid on and Donald Trump in Mar-a-Lago. That's obviously insane. Like something you would expect from like a banana republic, but it's so random because Trump. The whole there were investigations against Trump, but it feels like so random, and it's like things are not. But a lot of ways, like I want to get your thoughts on the raid against Trump, but it feels like everything. It's not even like it's not so much like planned out. It just
right.
It feels more. Just feels like so chaotic.
Let's spitwad here. Let's just go after Trump, but also too when you look at the way, and I'll just step back for a moment. When you look at the way Clinton ran her campaign in 2016, it's like they took the template from 1992 when Bill ran and just advanced it. No changes. This is how we do things. And I think there's a huge disconnect between these elites that are driving these policies, not even policies, it's even more strategic than that, these movements, that they really are disconnected from the reality of the day. So they're really caught in this position where they're forced to react. It's like, oh my gosh, we have to do something because if we don't, we're going to lose bigly in November.
Yeah, the thing is, like, with what they're doing with Trump, it doesn't seem like a calm, cold, calculated Machiavellian would do. It seems
right.
More like they're acting like they're panicking.
And I think that's my impression of all of this.
With quote unquote conspiracy theory concept, like there is truth to some of it, but I think like conspiracy theorists talk about those in power, like they're these all powerful omnipotent forces, which is obviously like that way of thinking is it has like some nuanced truth to it, but it's also deeply flawed.
Right. It's, you know, they're at the end of the day, they're humans. They make mistakes. They miscalculate. They didn't factor in how China might respond to something. They didn't factor in how Germany might respond to something. So, yeah, and we'll see it play out again in this time of a fourth turning. There's this view of let's just go for it, see what happens. Let's just roll the dice.
I think I don't know if you read the article I wrote, my Substack piece about the end. Is this the end of history? And
There
was, I guess if you look kind of like roughly summing up, like the 80s and 90s were fairly prosperous. It felt like the first two decades of the 21st century. This century, the 00s and 2010s, like obviously you had 9/11, you had the 08 crash, you had Occupy Wall Street, you had the Trump movement. But despite that, like I'd say overall, like those decades felt more decades of stagnation. And obviously, like there's something really depressing about stagnation. But yeah, I mean, again, it's like it's hard to make predictions, but it does feel like the 2020s are going to be like very chaotic. That's just how it seems so far.
Yeah, and I think I would agree with that's where I would put my money. I wouldn't downplay, you know, the populist movement that's going on right now. I was in Texas this weekend. I attended CPAC and talked to a lot of people. And CPAC is kind of a rhino point to surf. However, 75% of it was definitely America First. The people that were on stage, the people that, you know, the crowd wanted to see were definitely populist.
Viktor Orban wasn't. So you're seeing a shift because, or do you see like mainstream conservatism, like Reaganism, as still having an influence, or you do see
no, I see people reacting to solve problems the same way. I just look, you know, and I love Tom Frank's book, The People Know, The People Know, where he really looks at the populist movements of the late 19th century and early 20th century. I mean, when you look, you know, the whole concept, for instance, and this was Greidler's book, Secrets of the Temple, the whole concept of the Federal Reserve didn't come from academics, Wall Street types, economists of the day. It came from barefoot farmers that were struggling under the gold standard. And they had this notion of a Federal Reserve that would react to, it would allot for productivity. And, you know, William Jennings Bryan, you know,
It's interesting because William Jennings Bryant was actually against the gold standard, and being pro-gold standard was kind of like the wrong, actually, so he was on the opposite end of like the wrong.
Well yeah, because he was, the populists were against the gold standard because it was a highly deflationary system.
And it did that slow, pros and cons. Like the gold standard prevents inflation, but it
true.
Also... puts limits on economic growth. There are pros and cons.
Right. It, at that time, it was preventing wage inflation and inflation for crops that, you know, price inflation that would allow farmers to do better. But I bring that up because Jennings Bryant ran a absolutely brilliant campaign and could have won the office. However, there was a fellow by the name of Hannah. And he was really that version of, he was a political consultant genius. And he had gone to all of the, like at that time, the Fortune 500 companies. So he didn't have to really just go to New York City is all he had to do. And he told the businesses to open their books. And he said, give me 1% of your profits. And they did. So when William Jennings Bryan would go and speak in a city, he would have 10 other meetups, if you want to call them that, of his speakers, you know, slamming the populace and William Jennings Bryan. I mean, they just, you know, at the end of the day, outspoke them and, you know, won the war of ink. And in this whole process, they really hurt they did everything they could to discredit the populace, and they did a great job, and it lingers to today. Because to me, I have a very favorable notion to the term populist and populism, but many people don't, because I see it as a response to class warfare. Because whether Trump was being sincere or not, I believe he won in 2016 because he was actually speaking to class warfare. Because
I think Trump deserves a lot of skepticism. He's deeply flawed, but what's important is like what he was responding to. So did you actually meet him?
Oh, yeah. I met Trump on August 3rd, 2020. I was in the cabinet room with him, and he actually wrote he signed an executive order that I helped write, which was a bottom to top review of all federal agencies to find out who was using these H-1B visa dependent contractors. And we also, we saved 200 Tennessee Valley Authority IT jobs from being outsourced. And, you know, the funny thing there is a week later, the Jacobin had an article about it, and pretty much, you know, it was a backhanded compliment to me, maybe, but they're like, why is this, you know, nativist, racist Kevin Lynn saving union jobs? That should be our job.
Right,
and
I
wrote him back and I said, guys, I subscribed to your magazine. But that's the thing. I mean, the thing is, what was Trump really doing when he was at his best? He was solving real world problems, not ideological problems. And I think that's where populism is going to continue to garner steam, because the populists want to solve problems. The only thing that I found really concerning at CPAC, and I don't know how you feel about this, Robert, but the religiosity that seems to be permeating a lot of the America First movement now. When I see a governor of a state on stage saying he does what God tells him, I'm like, I don't know.
It's interesting. With George Bush, there was a strong religious right influence. And then with 2016, like the Trump movement felt more secular. And now you're seeing a big, it's called like Christian nationalism. That's become a huge thing on the right now.
Yeah, and I'm noticing, many people that I speak to who are America First candidates, really involved in the nuts and bolts and pulling the levers of the America First movement, are predominantly Roman Catholic. So I haven't quite figured out what's going on there.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
it's interesting because like the religious right was evangelical. I think evangelicals have declined in influence, but this like Catholic right thing is a huge phenomenon.
Yeah, and what was an interesting phenomenon, talking about phenomena, because I live here in the city of Lancaster in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
Is that Amish country?
It is. And I thought it was someone was spoofing everyone because the Amish, not like the Old Order Mennonite or different groups of Mennonites on the spectrum there, were attending Trump rallies, but actual Amish were pulling up in their carts and attending Trump rallies.
Really? Because I thought they tend to avoid politics.
They absolutely do. And when I spoke to friends of mine who know, for instance, whose families have been here since the 1750s, may not be Amish, but they have great relations. And I asked them, I said, is this true? And they're like, yeah, it's true, but they're all going to be in a lot of trouble.
Okay, right. That's interesting.
I haven't heard of anyone getting in a lot of trouble, and I followed up, and, you know, I'm sure the elders, you know, looked on in dismay, but think about it. For the Amish to, you know, the only other time they came out for some reason to vote for George W. Bush.
All right.
That I found really interesting, but, I mean, they... There were Trump flags on Amish carts.
Do you think Trump will run in 2024, or do you think it's going to be someone else like DeSantis?
I think for Trump not to run, he would have to say to himself, I don't have the mental faculties to do it. Short of that, I believe he'll run. I think he's going to run, if for no other reason, just vengeance.
Trump has a huge ego. And I think just for that reason, I think he'll likely run. And then, but who knows, it could be, I don't know, some of those saying it could be DeSantis, Tucker Carlson might run, maybe Jimmy Dore, who's like a left-wing.
Yeah,
populist.
I know Jimmy, yeah. Mm-hmm. Love his show. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he may run as a third party with the Populist Party.
Really?
Not the Populist Party, the People's Party. And then on the Democrat side, who knows who will be, if it will be Kamala Harris or Gavin Newsom, who knows?
I got a weird theory. I want to bounce it off.
We're at the end of the show, but I think before I wrap up, if you want to plug your theory, and then if you want to like plug your different websites and social media.
Okay, my theory is Kamala Harris. I hear these echoes of Spiro Agnew, and I'll leave that there. And I appreciate the opportunity to plug. If you want to get involved and help us, just go to our website, www.ustechworkers.com. That's where we talk about employment visas like H-1B. And be sure to sign up for that newsletter that comes out every other week. And then we also have the site, progressivesforimmigration.org, progressivesforimmigrationreform.org. Go there, read our posts, but also sign up for a newsletter there that comes out once a month.
Kevin Lin, great show. Thanks so much for being on.
Rob, this is always fun. Can't wait to ride again.